Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident. It's ultimately going into radiology. This will be the 79th episode of the Divine Intervention podcast, and I'll be talking about a step one topic today. In fact, today I'm going to be talking about hematology. Again, this is going to be a free form podcast. What I'm going to try to do is I'm just going to try to introduce like classic clinical cases as we go along, and I'll discuss them in the context of relevant step one material. And really, my focus today is going to be primarily on platelets. But I'm going to discuss let's see how, I'm really hoping to keep this to under an hour. So let's see how this goes. But my plan is to go for no more than an hour. But really, I want to talk about platelets, talk about many of the platelet disorders, and then maybe get to like some hemolytic diseases, some like exotic diseases that you find in the realm of hematology. Okay, so I'm going to try to follow first aid, just sort of make sure that I sort of cover my bases and basically cover the material in first aid. So this hematology podcast will be in a series, so this will be part one. And again, there are no slides for this. I'm beginning to realize that people get a lot more from my lectures by taking notes. So, every now and then I'll probably make slides if it's like absolutely necessary, but for the foreseeable future, I'm just going to make podcasts without slides. You listen to them, take notes. I think that's where a lot of the learning and retention will come from. So let's begin, right? So let's assume you get a question about a patient that has like, just, you know, they always seem to have like skin PTKI. So you're like, oh, maybe this person has some kind of bleeding disorder, right? And then you measure their PT, PTT is completely normal, right? But you measure their bleeding time and it's elevated. And then you're like, bleeding time is elevated. Let me do some more testing. And then you go ahead and you do something called the risdiplam cofactor assay, right? And you notice that, that assay is negative, right? So if you have these parameters at the back of your mind, what's your diagnosis? And think in terms of a genetic disorder, right? So PTKI, think of purpura, why not? PTPTT is fine. Bleeding time is elevated. Well, the risdiplam cofactor assay is abnormal, right? It's normal, right? So it's like negative. So hopefully that sort of leads you away from, because obviously, you know, this is a platelet disorder, right? Because this patient is having platelet style bleeding, basically, and I'll talk about that later in the podcast. But this patient is having platelet style bleeding because they're having like mucosal surface bleeding. That's classic whenever a patient has a platelet disorder. But the risdiplam cofactor assay is normal, so that basically rules out for Willebrand disease and what's the name of this other problem, Bernard-Sully syndrome. And also the PTT is fine, right? So that definitely helps you rule out von Willebrand disease. So we're going to settle on Glanzmann thrombocythemia as the cause of this patient's problem. And I'll talk about that as we go along. But with that case in point, let me go ahead and talk about like this coagulation cascade, right? So obviously we know the coagulation cascade involves primary and secondary hemostasis. Sort of like big picture, we know that primary hemostasis, it's like, I sort of think of it this way. So if a patient is like super sick, right? Let's say they come in, they're super, super sick, coming to the ED. Basically, the job of the ED physician is to stabilize them, right? And then after the ED physician stabilizes them, his next point of call is to move them to like, I don't know, like maybe like the ICU, right? For further management, right? So I sort of think of primary hemostasis as the ED physician's job. Just down and dirty medicine, get the person stabilized. And then after that, you ship the person off to the ICU. That's more secondary hemostasis. So really in primary hemostasis, your job is you want to just quick and dirty platelet plug. Okay. But the thing is that platelet plug, it's not very strong, right? So you'd probably want to try to, you know, strengthen it a little more. So the way you do that is by secondary hemostasis. So let's sort of talk about primary hemostasis first, right? So the first thing that happens is, let's assume you're stabbed, right? Or you get a nick in your skin, right? So you injure a blood vessel. Boo-hoo. Okay. So how does your body deal with that problem? The first thing your body does is to vasoconstrict, right? Because think about it, your body doesn't want you, your physiology is organized to hopefully make you not lose a lot of blood. So the first thing that happens is that you have like vasoconstriction, right? That vasoconstriction sort of kind of like decreases blood flow and it's like a local vasoconstriction, decreases blood flow, like blood loss from the area of injury, right? And the key thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for step one is that the key agent involved in that vasoconstriction is endothelin, right? Especially like endothelin 1. Hopefully you remember endothelin from my pulmonary pharmacology podcast, where I talked about pulmonary arterial hypertension, where we said that, oh, endothelin is a powerful vasoconstrictor. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, it's one of the most powerful vasoconstrictors in the body, right? So if you want to treat pulmonary arterial hypertension, you want to give an endothelin receptor antagonist, right? Like ambrisentan. Ambrisentan, we said that was an endothelin A receptor antagonist. And or you could use bosentan. We said bosentan was an endothelin A and B receptor antagonist. Okay, so just one of those weird times, I guess I want to bring in here. But basically, you have that vasoconstriction to sort of like reduce blood loss, right? And then you essentially have primary hemostasis happen. And primary hemostasis, it's a relatively simple process with a lot of moving parts, right? And I'll try to break it down for you. So the thing is, in primary hemostasis, right, there is like the adhesion step, right? That's basically, where the platelets sort of attach to collagen. And then there's the activation step where like some magic happens that I'll talk about shortly. And then there is the aggregation step where you form the weak platelet plug, right? So the first thing that happens, right, when you have injury, right, you basically, I sort of think of it as like sort of scrubbing away the endothelial cells from the surfaces of blood vessels. So when you scrub away those endothelial cells, guess what lies below endothelial cells? It's collagen, right? That's why that collagen is called subendothelial collagen. It's below endothelial cells. And that collagen, once it's basically exposed, certain things flowing in the blood, like platelets, will try to bind to it. But the thing is, that binding sort of needs an intermediary, right? So it sort of needs like a pastor to join that man and woman together. So how does that happen? So the thing that happens is, when you expose that subendothelial collagen, there is something known as GP1B that you... you have that GP1B that sort of you find on the surface of platelets, and then von Willebrand factor binds to that GP1B, and then that von Willebrand factor GP1B complex binds to that subendothelial collagen. That's the adhesion process of primary hemostasis, and it is actually very high yield to remember where von Willebrand factor comes from, right? These are just those weird trivia that your friends at the MBME love to test on the USMLEs, right? So it behooves you to remember that von Willebrand factor, you can actually find them in endothelial cells, okay? Don't forget that you can find them in Weibo-Palladi bodies. And then if you also look in platelets, platelets have certain granules like alpha granules. The alpha granules of platelets actually contain a von Willebrand factor. And while we're on this topic, don't forget your lamellar bodies in type 2 pneumocytes that help you store surfactant. That's actually very high yield to know for the USMLE step 1. Yeah, your friends at the MBMEs, they love these like cytoplasmic inclusions and whatnot. So just sort of keep those things at the back of your mind. Okay, so what are the key pathologies with this adhesion step, right? So with this adhesion step, you can have a deficiency of von Willebrand factor, right? Where you just don't have von Willebrand factor. Alternatively, you can have, and that's what's known as a von Willebrand disease. Alternatively, you can have a deficiency of GP1B, right? Basically, if you have these two, if you have a deficiency of either, the adhesion step of primary hemostasis is not going to happen, right? And if you notice from the earlier vignette I talked about, I mentioned the ristocetin cofactor assay. Basically, ristocetin is like an antibiotic that no one really knows how. But basically, if you put ristocetin in a patient's plasma, it will promote that adhesion step of primary hemostasis. So if you have a deficiency of any of those things like von Willebrand factor, aka von Willebrand disease, or GP1B, aka Bernard-Soulier syndrome, that ristocetin cofactor assay will be abnormal. Right, so that ristocetin cofactor assay is like a test. It's like a nice test for von Willebrand disease or for Bernard-Soulier syndrome, right? And one weird thing with because you may say, oh, divine, if they both have an abnormal ristocetin cofactor assay, how do I tell those two apart in exams? Here's how you'll tell them apart, right? So they are both platelet disorders, right? So obviously the person will have like mucosal bleeding and epistaxis and all that stuff, Fine. Okay. And because it's also a platelet disorder, the bleeding time will be elevated because bleeding time is elevated in pretty much every platelet disorder. Okay. But one thing that will help you on exams to differentiate between von Willebrand disease and again, please excuse my ums and ahs. I'm giving this this lecture literally from memory. So, although I sort of have an outline of like the topics I want to discuss, but the way you differentiate von Willebrand disease from Bernard-Soulier syndrome is that in von Willebrand disease, remember von Willebrand factor has two jobs in life basically, right? So one thing it does is it helps in this adhesion step of primary hemostasis. But another thing our lovely friend von Willebrand factor does is that it also sort of serves as a protecting group for factor 8, right? So like as I said, it's sort of thing of the bloodstream as kind of, you know, like kind of like a rough neighborhood. So you need like von Willebrand factor to sort of keep factor 8 going in the bloodstream. So if you have a deficiency on von Willebrand factor, well, guess what? There's no more protecting group for factor 8. If there's no protecting group for factor 8, your intrinsic cascade of secondary hemostasis does not work. I'll talk about that in a bit. So if that does not work, right, you'll have an elevation in PTT, right? So if you have an increase in bleeding time, an increase in PTT on an MBME exam, you should really not even bother reading the rest of the question. That's von Willebrand disease, okay? And please don't forget that von Willebrand disease is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? And you treat it with desmopressin, right? Desmopressin basically encourages your Weibull-Palladi buddies to release more von Willebrand factor, okay? So just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. I mean, there are many types of von Willebrand disease. I don't think it's necessarily high yield to know them, but one I would mention is one specific subtype that's kind of weird that you probably should not give let me discuss it this way. So there's a kind of von Willebrand disease where you do not want to give desmopressin. And in general, you probably don't even want to do there are many types of risdiocytin cofactor assays, but you don't want to do like the normal risdiocytin cofactor assay for those people. And it's type 2B von Willebrand disease. So let me basically describe what that does. So the thing is, in type 2B von Willebrand disease, people have like a weird von Willebrand factor that just loves to interact at more than normal levels with GP1B. So they just have like enhanced interactions between von Willebrand factor and GP1B, right? So obviously that increases a patient's risk of like hypercoagulability, right? So under those circumstances, it probably doesn't make sense to give a drug like desmopressin that will increase the release of that abnormal von Willebrand factor. Okay, so that type 2B von Willebrand's disease, you do not treat it with desmopressin. And in fact, if you did the risdiocytin cofactor assay, you will have like supraphysiologic levels of platelet adhesion. If you sort of want to take that to a more like logical conclusion, this is one of those things likely won't show up on step one, but if it does, it's like the more atypical von Willebrand disease. So I just have this weird feeling in my heart that it may just show up on a person's test and maybe the one question that prevents them from getting like a 270 or something ridiculous. So I guess I'll just go ahead and mention it. Okay, so those are the big things, right? So again, in Bernard-Soulier disease, you have an elevation in bleeding time, but your PTT will be normal because GP1B has no role in the protection of factor 8. Now, after that adhesion step of primary hemostasis, the next thing that happens is the activation step, right? Basically, once you have that adhesion step happen, your platelets begin to release stuff like ADP. The one we probably care about the most is ADP. I'll talk about thromboxanitin in a bit, but ADP is like the big one we care about right now. So you release that ADP. That ADP, think of it as like an autocrine process. The ADP will act on an ADP receptor. And that ADP receptor works through a signaling cascade that involves adenylate cyclase and cyclic AMP. Okay? So when ADP binds to that ADP receptor, that's the activation step of primary hemostasis that triggers that signaling cascade, right? And as that signaling cascade happens, that effectively leads to the third step of primary hemostasis, the aggregation step, where you express GP2B3A, and then that GP2B3 binds to factor 1, right? Remember, factor 1 is a fibrinogen, Okay, so GP2B3 on one platelet is bound by fibrinogen, right, or factor one. And then that or the other end of the fibrinogen is bound by GP2B3 from another platelet. And that's how you form the primary platelet plug. So what are some high yield things to sort of know along that cascade, right? So I just literally just told you that let's see. So I literally just told you that when ADP So I just told you that the ADP receptor works through a cyclic AMP system, right? So that tells you that it's a G protein coupled receptor. But one high yield thing you actually want to keep at the back of your mind is that it's not a GS receptor. It's not a stimulatory G protein coupled receptor. It's actually an inhibitory G protein coupled receptor, right? So it works through GI, right? So that actually tells you that that GI, right, you downregulate the activity of adenylate cyclase, so you make less cyclic AMP. And if you make less cyclic AMP, that actually promotes the next step of primary hemostasis, which is platelet aggregation, right? So really, if you keep that at the back of your mind that, oh, low cyclic AMP is good for primary hemostasis, that should tell you that, oh, high cyclic AMP is good if you want to be an antiplatelet drug. Right, so that's how drugs like celostazole and dipyridamole work. They are phosphodiesterase inhibitors. By inhibiting phosphodiesterase, you decrease the breakdown of cyclic AMP. So cyclic AMP builds up. As cyclic AMP builds up, you basically inhibit that. You're basically like stopping that activation step of primary hemostasis because you are essentially reversing the effects of the signaling cascade through the ADP receptor. And please don't forget that the ADP receptor is also known as the P2Y12 receptor, and it's blocked by drugs like clopidogrel and prasugrel and ticlopidine and ticagrelor, right? So those are your P2Y12 receptor blockers. Although I talk about all these drugs in my HEMA pharmacology podcast, so I'll encourage you to sort of go back and look at those. And then one high yield pathology you want to sort of keep at the back of your mind is that GP2B3A, right? I just talked about that as being involved in the aggregation step of primary hemostasis. If you had a deficiency of that, well, you will have issues with platelet aggregation, right? And that disease is known as Glanzmann thrombocythemia, right? But remember, that was basically the diagnosis for the case I posed earlier on, right? And the reason I posed that question is that basically if a patient has Glanzmann thrombocythemia, they do not form, they will have a normal restocytin cofactor assay because it's a platelet aggregation problem. It's not a platelet adhesion problem. And they will also have an elevated bleeding time because it's a platelet issue, but their PT and PTT will be completely normal, okay? Because again, GP2B3 does not have any like extra life function like von Willebrand factor does. And one thing I'll just sort of mention, so that it sort of serves as a tip off on exams, is that Glanzmann thrombocythemia and Bernard-Soulier disease, they are usually on exams associated with like large megakaryocytes if you do like a bone marrow smear or something like that. So just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then remember that there are drugs that have the ability to block the GP2B3 receptor, right? So there are drugs like apsiximab, that's like a monoclonal antibody. There is a drug known as a tirofiban, right? And then there is another drug, I believe it's a small molecule, is known as a eptifibatide. They all block those GP2B3 receptors, right? And one other thing you may also want to think about with the GP2B3 receptor is this disease known as ITP, immune thrombocytopenic purpura. Classically, right, that will present on exams as like a kid that recently had like an upper respiratory viral infection, right? And then they tell you that that kid, as they were brushing their teeth, they noticed like a lot of like gingival bleeding. And then their mom brings them to the ED. And then you check their platelet counts like 2. You're like, that's weird, right? If you ever see that, think about ITP, right? ITP, right? So it's just like an isolated thrombocytopenia. And really, for the most part, you don't treat. But if those people have like severe bleeding or their platelet count is like super low, you can give them like steroids or you can give them IVIG. Okay, so in ITP, basically the thing that happens is you make antibodies against GP2B3A. You make IgG antibodies against the GP2B3A, right? And then those IgG antibodies, obviously, right, they can, remember that IgG can activate the classic complement cascade. So that constant region of the IgG can be bound by complement, and you basically destroy your platelets that way, okay? So that's why you have the thrombocytopenia part in ITP. Okay, so that's the classic way it presents on exams, just how you think you want to know. And then another drug, right, I guess I could talk about, or a molecule that's released in that activation step, right? So that's like the second step of primary hemostasis, is something known as a thromboxane A2. Okay, thromboxane A2. The thing is thromboxane A2, right? So think of it thromboxane, right? So think of it as something that is thrombogenic. Thromboxane basically promotes platelet aggregation. Okay, and the thing is thromboxane A2 is actually made through that arachidonic acid cascade, right? So from like cyclooxygenase. So that's why a drug like aspirin is a good antiplatelet drug. Please don't make this mistake. Aspirin is an antiplatelet drug. It's not an anticoagulant. An anticoagulant, by definition, is a drug that works on secondary hemostasis. An antiplatelet drug, by definition, is a drug that works on primary hemostasis. So aspirin irreversibly inhibits cyclooxygenase. So when you inhibit cyclooxygenase, you do not make thromboxane A2. So you basically inhibit the formation of thromboxane A2. So you don't have a platelet aggregation. That's why aspirin is an antiplatelet drug. So, and then I guess you can think of like the anti-thromboxane A2, things like a prostacycline, like PGI2. Think of PGI2 as like platelet gathering inhibitor. Okay, those things inhibit platelet aggregation, okay, and they also may throw that arachidonic acid cascade, right? So things like prostacycline, so like PGI2, nitric oxide, right, those things all sort of inhibit platelet aggregation, and they're also very good vasodilators, right? So if, for example, you wanted to keep a doctor's arteriosus open, say for example if a kid has like a cyanotic congenital heart defect, you can give a prostacycline analog, right? So like a Prostadil, for example. So again, just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind, for exams. So I think I have said all the high yield things I want to say about primary hemostasis. So I guess I can, why don't I jump on to my next, topic I want to discuss, which will be secondary hemostasis. But before we do that, let's talk about a clinical case, right? So let's assume you get a question, okay, about a person from Greece, right? Whenever I think of Greece, I think of Giannis Antetokounmpo, the Milwaukee Bucks guy, but a different story. So back to the real world. So let's say you have a person from Greece, okay? And for some reason, they keep having, just recurrent, they've had let's say it's like a 20-year-old that has had like 5 PEs, like 5 pulmonary emboli, and they've had multiple DVTs and whatnot, right? And they give it as like a nondescript question on the USMLE, and they ask for the diagnosis. Well, hopefully you're thinking about factor 5 Leiden. In fact, factor 5 Leiden, if I'm not mistaken, is the most common. Actually, very high yield to know that. This is more step 2 question, but it's the most common hypercoagulable disorder. Okay, so factor 5 Leiden basically arises where you have factor 5 that just refuses to be broken down by protein C and protein S. So I'll talk about the mechanism behind that as we sort of proceed through secondary hemostasis. So we say that primary hemostasis, right, you basically end at that platelet aggregation step where GP2B3A, right, is bound by fibrinogen or factor 1, right? And that basically forms the weak platelet plug. So the thing is fibrinogen, right? Ogen, right? So that's like a zymogen. So you want to get it to something that's a little more stable so that you can essentially stabilize that platelet plug. Okay, so that would be the whole point of secondary hemostasis. So now you're sending those super sick stabilized patients to the ICU, right? You're basically trying to change that fibrinogen to fibrin. Okay, fibrinogen is actually factor 1. You want to change it to fibrin. Okay, that's like factor 1A, if you may. And then by doing that, you basically stabilize the platelet plug, right? So obviously, that's where secondary hemostasis sort of comes into play. And the thing about secondary hemostasis is there's two parts, okay? So there's the extrinsic part, there's like the extrinsic cascade, and there's the intrinsic cascade. And the thing is, there's a crap ton of factors that sort of work along these cascades. The thing I will just tell you right off the bat is, you don't necessarily need to remember all the steps, but you absolutely positively, I will say, to be honest, it probably just makes sense to remember all the steps, because there's just so many pathologies along the way. But at the same time, I probably, let's say you're like, Divine, I there's no way I can remember all the stuff. What you can do is you can just, you know, try to remember at least the clotting factors in the intrinsic versus the extrinsic cascade, because it will help you answer certain questions, especially with the hemophilias and PTs and INRs and all that stuff. And I'll talk about that right now, actually. So let's sort of walk through the different cascades, right? So let's do the simple one first, right? So the extrinsic cascade. The extrinsic cascade, it's actually not that bad. It basically involves factor 7, right? Factor 7 sort of is the big thing in that cascade, and also, I guess, factor 3. Another name for factor 3 is actually tissue factor, right? So basically, tissue factor, right, or factor 3, converts like factor 7 to like its active form, factor 7a. Okay, and then that factor 7 has the ability to convert factor 10 to factor 10a. Okay, and then that factor 10a can help you convert like prothrombin, which is factor 2, to thrombin, which is activated factor 2, right? And then that thrombin can then go ahead and convert that fibrinogen or factor 1 that bound to GP2B3a to fibrin. Okay, although one thing I'll go ahead and say is that that fibrin, you actually do not just leave it at that. The thing is that fibrin is, you actually form like even more stable crosslinks in that fibrin with something known as factor 13, okay? Factor 13. Factor 13 basically establishes some really awesome crosslinks in that fibrin, so you form an even more stable platelet plug. The thing is, if you wanted to go from that factor 13 to like the activated factor 13, you actually also do that with factor 2, right? So thrombin has multiple jobs. In fact, I will tell you that for purposes of your exam, think of thrombin or factor 2a, right, as having three jobs, right? So I already mentioned two. The first thing is it converts fibrinogen to fibrin, right? And then the second thing is that it helps you convert factor 13 to factor 13a, and that factor 13a, like I said, helps you establish, you know, pretty nice crosslinks within between fibrin, so that you can have a more stable platelet plug. The third rule is that, in fact, I'll talk about, let me hold my horses for now. I'll sort of talk about that in a bit. But that's really the extrinsic cascade. And really, the way you monitor the extrinsic cascade is with something called PT-INR. Okay, that's the way you monitor that extrinsic cascade versus the intrinsic cascade that is monitored with like PTT, right? And I'll in my Heme Pharmacology podcast, I talked about how PT, PTT, INR, and all that stuff sort of relate with heparin and warfarin. So again, I'll encourage you to go back and listen to those podcasts. They are like one of my earlier podcasts when I started this website. So, so with the intrinsic cascade, right? So what? So I guess let me sort of summarize. For the extrinsic cascade, basically think of factor 7, factor 3, right? And then everything after factor 10. And everything after factor 10 really is factor 10 itself, right? And then factor 2. Although the thing is, for factor 10 to actually convert factor 2 to its active form, it actually uses factor 5 as a cofactor. Okay, so basically, again, extrinsic cascade, think of 7, 3, 3 is a tissue factor, think of 10, think of 5, think of 2, and think of 1. Okay, so just sort of remember it in ascending order. So like 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, and yeah, that's it. So 1, 2, 3, 5, 7. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 5, 7. 1, 2, 3, 5, 7. And also 10, I guess. So 1, 2, 3, 5, 7. So 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, and 10. And you're good to go on the extrinsic cascade. The intrinsic cascade, again, also gets to factor 10. But the thing is, prior to getting there, you have like factor 12 going to factor 12a. And then 12a converts 11 to 11a. And then 11a converts factor 9 to 9a. Okay? And then factor 9a uses factor 8a convert factor 10 to 10a, okay? And then factor 10a again uses factor V's help to convert factor 2, that's prothrombin, to 2A, that's thrombin, and then you go from fibrinogen to fibrin, okay? And then remember that, again, factor 13, the activated form of factor 13 helps you with, you know, forming awesome crosslinks between those, between fibrin. So really, for the intrinsic cascade, the big thing you want to remember is it involves factors 12, 11, 9, and 8, and then everything after factor 10, right? So 12, 11, 9, and 8. So 8, 9, 11, 12, 8, 9, 11, 12, okay? And then everything from factor 10, okay? And really, if you remember that, you are good to go for the most part. And the reason you need to remember this is, again, you'll see as I begin to talk about the different hemophilias, everything will sort of begin to fall into line up nicely. So I said that, but actually, so I've talked about the intrinsic cascade and the extrinsic cascade, but the thing is, there are actually some other high yield things you sort of want to know here. So the thing is, if you notice, if you look at that factor 10 step, one step that comes before it in the intrinsic cascade is where factor 9A uses the help of factor 8A to help you convert factor 10 to factor 10A. And then right after that factor 10A step in converting prothrombin of factor 2 to thrombin of factor 2A, you have factor 5 helping in that process. So I thought, sort of think of factor 8 and factor 5 as helpers of secondary hemostasis. Well, here's the thing. It so happens that those helpers are actually inhibited by a protein known as protein C, okay? And the thing is, protein C does not act alone. It has like a partner in crime, okay? That partner in crime is, think of it as like a cofactor, protein S, okay? And the thing is, protein C actually cannot do its dirty deeds without being activated, right? So the thing is, protein C is sort of like a dead, it doesn't work. But if you change it to activated protein C, it becomes like the Incredible Hulk, okay? So to get it from protein C to activated protein C, you actually need the help of factor 2. Factor 2 actually binds to something called a thrombomodulin, and then that factor 2 thrombomodulin complex essentially converts protein C to activated protein C, and then that activated protein C sort of pairs up with its partner in crime, protein S, and then they inhibit those helpers of secondary hemostasis, factors 8 and factor 5. Right, so sort of think of this as like a nice way that factor 2 can sort of shut down, like it's kind of like a negative feedback mechanism for factor 2 with regards to secondary hemostasis, right? So I say that factor 2 has three jobs. So I just mentioned the third job. So let's sort of summarize. So factor 2, the first job is to convert factor 1 of fibrinogen to factor 1A of fibrin. Second thing is factor 2 actually converts factor 13 to factor 13A, right? So that's where, remember, factor 13A helps you like form awesome crosslinks between a fibrin. And then the third job of factor 2 is that it binds to thrombomodulin. And then that complex, right, the thrombin thrombomodulin complex, converts protein C to activated protein C. And then that activated protein C joins up with its partner in crime, protein S, to inhibit factors 8 and 5. Okay? Just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then there is something known as antithrombin 3. Antithrombin 3 is a nice molecule that basically helps you inhibit factors 10 and factor 2. Okay, it inhibits factor 10 and 2, factor 10 and 2, factor 10 and 2. Antithrombin 3 inhibits those things. And again, I apologize. Like, I am super, super sorry that I'm inundating you with all this detail, but I promise you, all this detail is very high yield for step one. So don't say, oh, this has to be low yield. No, I promise you it's not low yield. This is one of those weird things that you likely see on step one. And then, believe it or not, some of these things pop up on exams like step two CK and step three. Many people think that after step one, they can wave a final goodbye to basic sciences. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Basically, I think of step one as the USMLE exam that has the greatest proportion of basic science questions, and then step three has the least proportion of basic science questions. So on all the USMLEs, you will always see basic science questions. It's just a matter of how many, Okay, so just one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So let's talk about some high yield stuff with these pathways, right? So first thing I talked about is antithrombin 3, right? Antithrombin 3 in the Heme Pharmacology podcast, you remember me talking about heparin that basically supercharges the effect, the ability of antithrombin 3 so that it can inhibit factors 10 and factor 2 some more. That's why heparin, right, acts as an awesome anticoagulant. But if your friends at the MBME want to integrate antithrombin 3 with nephrotic syndrome, remember in nephrotic syndrome, right, where you basically pee out more than 3.5 grams of protein in a 24-hour period, those people, unfortunately, right, let go of antithrombin 3 in their urine, right? So think about it. If you let go of antithrombin 3 in your urine, you're essentially hypercoagulable. That's why kidney disease, nephrotic syndrome is bad, right? Because you are basically hypercoagulable because you are losing anticoagulant, in this case, antithrombin 3 in your urine. If you lose that antithrombin 3 in your urine, factors 10 and factors 2 work unopposed, so you are hypercoagulable, right? Another high-yield way they can sort of integrate this is there are people that actually have a deficiency of antithrombin 3. If a patient has a deficiency of antithrombin 3, right? So obviously, if you give those people heparin, they will not, they will not respond to it much, right? They would, basically, they can give it on, the nice way they can put it on an exam is, a patient gets heparin, like at the right time, right dose, right everything. And then they tell you that the patient still got like a PE or a DVT while being on heparin. That's kind of odd, right? So that should sort of lead you down that pathway. Another way they can sort of mess with your head, more comprehensively, is to basically tell you, like, give you like an experimental question, right? So like these questions where they give experiments on the USMLEs. And then they talk about like controls. So they can talk about like a randomized trial or whatever. Talk about like two groups of patients. They talk about controls. And they say, oh, these people got an agent. And the agent, basically, let's say their baseline, I can't remember the like normal values off the top of my head, but let's say baseline PTT is 1, right? And then after those people got an agent, their PTT increased to 5. And then let's say that the test subjects, you give them an agent. This agent I'm describing is basically heparin. And their PTT at baseline was 1. And then their PTT after getting the heparin was like 1.1, right? And then they say, oh, maybe they had to get like 50 times the normal amount of heparin to achieve that PTT of 5. That's basically a backhand way to test antithrombin 3 deficiency. The reasoning behind that is that if you have an antithrombin 3 deficiency, right, you need high, you basically do not respond to heparin. So you need like higher than normal doses of heparin for you to even get any measurable increase in your PTT. Okay, so that's a very high yield thing they can test on exams. So antithrombin 3 deficiency is actually a hypercoagulable disorder, right? And then the main topic of my discussion, right, so like the case I sort of brought up at the beginning, where I talked about factor 5 Leiden, right? So remember I said that protein C, after getting converted to activated protein C under the action of a factor 2 and thrombomodulin, right, with protein S as its partner in crime, protein C and protein S, they inhibit factors 8 and 5, right? So the thing is, if you have factor 5 Leiden, you basically have like, it's like a kind of like a point mutation where basically factor 5 becomes resistant to degradation by factor activated protein C. If that's the case, right, factor 5 will have like prolonged effects, it will hang around for longer, and that will also increase your risk of hypercoagulable issues, right? So like PEs and DVTs and whatnot. And really the way you test for factor 5 Leiden, right, is to do something called an activated protein C resistance assay, right? So activated protein C resistance assay, that's sort of like the test for factor 5 Leiden. And don't forget that people of Mediterranean descent are the classic people that get factor 5 Leiden on our USMLEs. And basically, I'll tell you this. If they give you like a nondescript question where like they give you very few clues and the person is hypercoagulable, think about factor 5 Leiden. It's actually the most common, actually very high yield to know that. It's the most common hypercoagulable disorder in the world, if I'm not mistaken. So that's factor 5 Leiden. Now, I mean, if you have a protein C or a protein S deficiency, that will also make you hypercoagulable, right? Because those people cannot inhibit factors 8 and 5, right? So they have, again, very high risk of like PEs and DVTs and whatnot. Let's see, what other things will be tested along this pathway? Oh, the hemophilias. Okay, so let me give you a series of questions and then let's sort of go from there, right? So, Oh, I have a great idea before I talk about the hemophilias. Let me present it as a question. So let's assume you have a patient, okay, that presents with a lot of like, you know, they present with like an arthritis-like picture. You know what, let me not make it an arthritis-like picture because this disease I'm about to talk about is very common in kids. I mean, it's super rare, but kids are the most common patients that, like, basically are the most common patients with this kind of disorder. So let's assume you have a patient that, let's say it's a 6-month-old kid, and the mom says that this kid, you know, had like minor surgery, like to take out his tonsils, and this kid bled a lot. Like literally, this kid required like a ton of blood transfusions. And then let's say that they tell you that, oh, this kid just bleeds and bleeds and bleeds and bleeds. And that even if you even look at the joints, like the kid's joints, let's say you see like a lot of red, like hemarthrosis and whatnot. And then they decide to do some hematologic studies, right? So I can foresee this, your friends at the MBME, like sort of like just grinning and sort of smiling to themselves as they write this question, like an experimental style question. And then they tell you that, oh, they check the PT. It's absolutely fine. They check the PTT, it is absolutely fine. They check the bleeding time and it's absolutely fine. You're like, come on, what's going on here, right? Because if you see a question like that, you're like, oh, joint bleeding, all that stuff, blah, 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 blah. Oh, this has to be a clotting factor problem, right? Oh, this has to be a hemophilia. But the thing is the hemophilias, right? So we have like hemophilia A, that's a deficiency of factor 8. And hemophilia B, that's a deficiency of factor 9, right? So you've probably heard of the mnemonic that hemophilia A sounds like 8 and vitamin B9, right? So hemophilia B or like the word B9, right? So hemophilia B is like a factor 9 deficiency. That's kind of like a nice way to remember those things. And then there's also hemophilia C, that's a factor 11 deficiency. If you notice, factors 8, 9, and 11 are all a part of the intrinsic cascade of secondary hemostasis, right? So if they are all parts of the intrinsic cascade, right, that can already tell you that, oh, in these disorders, the only thing that will be elevated will be PTT, okay? The PT will not be elevated. Again, very high yield to know that. The PT is not elevated in the hemophilias, but the PTT will. Because remember, the PT is a proxy for the extrinsic coagulation cascade that I just mentioned involves factors 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, and 10, right? That's it. Versus the intrinsic cascade that includes all the other clotting factors, okay? So, factors 8, 9, and 11, they are not part of the extrinsic cascade. So, your PT or INR will not rise in the setting of hemophilia, okay? But your PTT definitely will. But you have a question where the patient basically is presenting as like a hemophiliac, but the PT and PTT is absolutely normal. If you ever see that, and again, this is one of those 270 style USMLE questions, think about a factor 13 deficiency, okay? Think about a factor 13 deficiency. Because if you really think about it, factor 13 is not part of secondary hemostasis, right? It doesn't do anything to the intrinsic cascade, doesn't do anything to the extrinsic cascade. All it does is the product of secondary hemostasis, which is fibrin, it basically puts awesome cross-links between fibrin. Okay, so if you see a hemophilia style question where the PT and PTT are fine, I really want you to think about factor 13 deficiency on your exams. So, and then, I mean, factor 10 in the Heme Pharmacology podcast, I talk about like the factor 10 inhibitors, like they all have XA in their name, right? So like XA, like 10A, right? So like rivaroxaban, apixaban, edoxaban, stuff like that, right? And then there are also like drugs that are factor 2 inhibitors, right? So drugs like what are they? You know, like weird names like bivalirudin. That's like sort of derived from leeches, because remember, leeches, right? For them to suck your blood, they basically inject an anticoagulant into you so that you basically bleed very nicely, so they can suck your blood very nicely, right? So bivalirudin is derived from, I mean, if you remember the if you remember back to those fancy days in college where you had to learn those biological taxonomies, and you learned about leeches, remember leeches belong to the class Hirudinea. Okay, so Hirudinea, that's why the drug names, right, sort of like bivalirudin, lepirudin, right, Hirudinea, they all come from leeches. And then there are also drugs like agatroban, dabigatran. Those are all direct factor 2 inhibitors. Okay, so like the hirudin derivatives, agatroban, dabigatran, those are factor 2 inhibitors. And actually, two high yield things you sort of want to know about those drugs, right? So those drugs will classically be the answer if a patient has a HIT, so heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, right? So let's assume you get a question about a patient comes in for surgery, and then as a post-surgical DVT prophylaxis, which happens in basically every patient, they get like heparin, or basically any kind of heparin product. So they get those heparin products, and they will give you like 2 sets of labs on the USMLEs, right? They'll show you like, oh, post-op day 1, their platelet count was like, I don't know, like 300,000. And then post-op day 5, their platelet count is like 60,000, right? And they got like low molecular weight heparin or like normal heparin. And then they tell you that, oh, on post-op day 5, they begin to have like necrosis of an extremity, or they have like a PE or a DVT, and then they have like that low platelet. Think about HIT, right? So remember, HIT is like a hypercoagulable disorder where basically something called a platelet factor 4 binds to heparin, and then that heparin platelet factor 4 complex, you basically make antibodies against it, like IgG antibodies. And then those IgG antibodies, remember, IgG, and just like IgM can activate the classic complement cascade. So those antibodies, they both consume platelets, right? So you get a thrombocytopenia. That's why your platelet count goes down. But also that antigen antibody complex actually has the ability to activate platelets. So you become hypercoagulable. So you become hypercoagulable under those circumstances, you sort of get in trouble, right? So it's like one of those weird disorders where your platelet count is low, but you are actually hypercoagulable. So the next step in general for HIT is to stop the heparin drug. So let's say they were getting like unfractionated heparin, they will try to give you an answer on the exam that says, oh, switch them to low molecular weight heparin. No, those patients, they should never get any heparin products in the future, ever. Okay, so you basically stop every heparin product, and the treatment of choice are those direct factor 2 inhibitors like bivalirudin, right, or agatroban, or dabigatran, right? There's another drug known as fondaparinux. That's a factor 2 inhibitor. You can also use it for the treatment of HIT. So that's one classic way on exams that those are factor 2 inhibitors are tested. Another weird way that those drugs may be tested, especially a dabigatran. Dabigatran in the hospital, you probably remember it as a Pradaxa. So it so happens that, remember before, the prevailing teaching was that, ooh, those factor 2 inhibitors, there are no drugs that can reverse them. That's not really the case anymore, right? So if a patient gets dabigatran, right, and they're like bleeding, right, because of a powerful anticoagulant, you can actually reverse it with a monoclonal antibody. In the hospital, it's known as Praxbind, but on the USMLEs, the term you'll see is a drug known as idarucizumab. So idarucizumab, idarucizumab. It's a monoclonal antibody against dabigatran, so you can actually use it to reverse the effects of dabigatran. I don't know if that's made its way to first aid, but I'm almost certain it'll potentially show up on a USMLE in the very near future if it has not already. So, so I think that's all I'm going to say about secondary hemostasis. Let me see. Is there any other thing I want to discuss here? I don't know. I feel like I've talked about everything I want to talk about. Oh, yeah. And I guess just as trivia, don't forget, right? Hemophilia A and B, right? Will show up in boys on exams, right? Because they're inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion versus hemophilia C. That's actually inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. The way I just remember it is like hemophilia car, right? So like a car, right? So like hemophilia C, autosomal recessive. That's a way to remember that. So if you see like a hemophilia-like picture again, PTT is abnormal in a girl on your test, the only correct answer is hemophilia C, right? Because again, hemophilia A, B, and C will increase your PTT, but hemophilia A and B only show up in boys. So if you see a hemophilia-like picture and the PTT is high and it's in a girl, don't bother reading the rest of the question. It has to be hemophilia C. Like literally, that's the only hemophilia permutation that fulfills all those criteria. I'll sort of encourage you to sort of pause and sort of reason through that. But if you see PTT elevated in a boy, okay, think about hemophilia A or B. If your friends at the MBME are like kind of like tricky, they want to like mess with your head, and like they give you like question, it's a boy, hemophilia like picture, bloody bloody blah, and you're like, and they give you hemophilia A and B as answer choices, believe it or not, you may say, oh divine, there's no way they can do that to me. Think again. They can actually do that to you, so I'll just sort of throw that out there. And they put hemophilia A and B as answer choices. Pick hemophilia A. Here's why. Hemophilia A is a lot more common than hemophilia B. So A is the more correct answer on an MBME. And then if they give you again, hemophilia-like picture, PT, PTT are just fine, regardless of sex. Think about a factor 13 deficiency. Now, one other thing I'll mention is, I guess, the concept of a mixing study. Right, I believe I talked about this in one of my earlier hematology podcasts, right, where I basically talked about these weird hematologic tests that tend to sort of mess with people's heads on exams. But let's see, what do I want to say here? So come on, divine thing. So those hemophilias, right? So it's basically a deficiency of those clotting factors. The thing is, to sort of diagnose those disorders, one thing you can do is you can actually go ahead and you can do something called a mixing study, right? So you basically give like normal plasma of on an unaffected patient that contains those clotting factors. When you give normal plasma, basically you're basically supplying the clotting factors that patient is missing. So that basically sort of helps you confirm the diagnosis of the hemophilias. So let me give you a classic way this can be tested, right? So one classic way it can be tested is a patient has hemophilia A, right? You know, obviously their PGT will be high, right? And then let's say they give you a question and they say, oh, addition of control serum to the patient's blood sample results in a normalization of the PGT. If you see that, that's basically like, they're basically using like a backhand means of describing a mixing study. Think about a hemophilia, okay? But here is where you want to be careful. And I'll probably spend 5 minutes on this because it's a very high yield thing. Shows up on all the USMLEs. The thing is, you really need to understand the difference between a clotting factor disorder and a clotting factor inhibitor disorder. Okay, so you need to understand the differences again between a clotting factor disorder and a clotting factor inhibitor disorder. Now, let me define what I mean by clotting factor inhibitor. A clotting factor inhibitor is a drug, is basically like, I sort of think of it as an antibody that binds to clotting factors. Okay. And the thing is, usually you can differentiate between those two scenarios by doing a mixing study. So what do I mean by that? The thing is, if you have like a hemophilia A, for example, and you're missing factor 8, well, okay, you go ahead and give the patient, you do a mixing study, you give like normal serum, that fixes the problem, right? That's a good mixing study, right? That tells you, okay, this person has a clotting factor disorder. But let's assume you do a mixing study and the PTT does not normalize. That tells you that you have a clotting factor inhibitor in that patient's serum. And why is that? The thing is, walk with me here for a second. If you gave that patient a clotting factor, if a patient has a clotting factor inhibitor disorder, like, I don't know, like antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, right? And you gave them that normal serum, they still have those clotting factor antibodies in their serum. So those antibodies are sort of hanging out. When you do the mixing study, the antibodies that are in the patient's serum will bind to the new clotting factors you're bringing in through the normal from like the normal patient, like the normal blood that you're sort of using as control for your mixing study. So they will bind up those clotting factors, the new clotting factors you're supplying. So the PTT will not normalize. So very, it's like it's a subtle point, but it's floridly high you ought to know for exams. If the PTT does not normalize with a mixing study, you do not want to think about a clotting factor disorder. You want to think about a clotting factor inhibitor disorder. Classically on exams, it's the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. But that's not where it stops. The thing is, your friends at the NBME, they know that people have sort of, I mean, it's not many people that have figured this out, but they know that a decent number of people have figured out that, oh, you know what? Everyone knows that antiphospholipid antibody syndrome is a clotting factor inhibitor disorder. So they've started devising more nifty means of testing the same concept. So let me sort of just describe the situation, because it's if I sort of make it as a question, I mean, it's almost 2 a.m. here. I don't know. I just let me just try to make this podcast short, because I mean, this is almost 1 hour and there's still quite some stuff I actually want to talk about. So let's assume a patient has hemophilia A. Right, one way you can treat hemophilia A, or I guess let's say hemophilia B, right? Let's say hemophilia B, right? So factor 9 problem. One way you can treat hemophilia B is basically to give that person what they're missing, give them like recombinant factor 9. Okay, the thing is, over time, as you keep giving a person recombinant factor 9. The thing that may actually happen is that because it's not native to the patient's body, right, because they're deficient in it, they may actually begin to make antibodies against that factor 9. And when they make those antibodies, guess what? You've basically converted them from having a clotting factor disorder to having a clotting factor inhibitor disorder. So the classic way they will test that on an exam is they will say, oh, you know what? There's this patient that has hemophilia B, and let's say like 5 years ago, you only had to give them like, I'm just making this up, like 10 units of recombinant factor 9, and they're good to go. Their PTT normalizes. But now they tell you that they are requiring like 100 units of recombinant factor 9 for their PTT to normalize. So basically, in effect, they're requiring higher and higher and higher amounts, or I guess larger is the better term, larger and larger and larger amounts of recombinant factor 9 for their PTT to normalize. That basically tells you that those people are having, they basically started making antibodies against that factor 9 you're giving them, okay? So those antibodies are inhibiting whatever factor 9 you give. So you have to give like super high amounts to overwhelm those antibodies to normalize the PTT. That's a very nifty way they can test that concept. It's one of those weird things you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind on the USMLEs. Okay. So that's all I'm going to say there. So I've talked about, I'm just trying to make sure I've not missed any big thing with secondary hemostasis. I already talked about like antithrombin 3, and now it inhibits factors 10 and 2. I mean, it also inhibits other things, but those are lower yield. It inhibits like factor 12, factor 11, inhibits factor 9. But I mean, I guess it's not that hard to remember, right? So it's like, it inhibits like factor 2, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12. So basically it inhibits factors 9 through 12 and 2 and 7, right? And if you really add it up 2 and 7, you get 9, right? So it's not super hard to remember. And then I guess, don't forget, right, that one thing I missed out on, right? So fibrin, right? Fibrin, the thing is, if you actually want to break up clots, right, you can actually use something to break down that fibrin. That fibrin, you break it down into like literally degradation products of fibrin. They are known as fibrin degradation products. And actually, there's a specific type of fibrin degradation product known as a D-dimer. That's usually elevated in like DIC, right? And remember, there are many things that can cause DIC. I'll probably talk about that in a different podcast. The thing that helps you break down fibrin to like fibrin degradation products is plasmin. But the thing is, plasmin is a protein. There's a zymogen form of plasmin. It's known as plasminogen. Okay, so plasminogen is converted to plasmin. And there's a drug that activates that process, right? So TPA, right? So TPA helps you go from plasminogen to plasmin. That's why TPA is a good clot busting drug, right? So it's, again, one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind with a secondary hemostasis. So I think I'm going to, I think that's all I want to say about secondary hemostasis. But you know what? Let me just talk about transfusions. Because really, like all the things I sort of had planned out for this podcast, the way I'm seeing it will probably take like 2.5 hours. And I don't know how good that will be to my listeners. So let me just talk about transfusions. That'll probably be like 10 minutes and then we'll be done. And then the other topics, I'll just talk about them at a different time. And again, I promise I will try to make more podcasts. It's just really hard with an intern year. I mean, you'll see me making a podcast at like 1 a.m., 2 a.m. in the morning. Trust me, there's a reason for that. If I could make it during the day, I'll obviously make it during the day. But it's not really easy to do that. I kind of got home early from work, so I was able to sleep. So I'm sort of finding it difficult to sleep now since I got so much sleep after I got home in the afternoon. So I'm like, I might as well use this free time to make a podcast. Okay, so let's sort of talk about, talk about transfusions. Right. So let me sort of introduce this with a vignette. Right. Yeah. Let's introduce a vignette. So let's assume you get this question right. So let's assume you have a 44-year-old female. She has a like chronic beta thal minor. Okay. And she basically comes to an infusion center. You know, for like a scheduled like red blood cell transfusion for like bad anemia. And basically, like 5 minutes into the transfusion, her blood pressure sort of tanks. Her blood pressure is like 65 over 40. Her respiratory rate is like 40, right? Her normal respiratory rate is between like 10 and 16, something like that. Her heart rate is like 149, so she's tachycardic. And her temperature is like 101, so she's super febrile. And she's like complaining of like difficulty breathing. And you'll sort of listen to her chest and you hear like wheezing everywhere. And then this is like a boss phrase you want to remember for exams. They tell you that you do a physical exam and she has flank pain. That's like floridly high yield to know. Okay. She has flank pain. And then let's say like, oh, on the way to the ICU, you sort of inserted a Foley catheter and you see like blood in her urine. Right. Now, my question is, what is the most likely mechanism that explains this patient's findings, right? So let me give you a few options here. So let's say option A is a release of cytokines from stored blood. Option B is antigen-antibody complex-mediated vasculitis. Option C is a preformed antibody against the donor red blood cell antigens. Option D is an anaphylactic reaction secondary to recipient anti-IgA antibodies. And then option E is mast cell degranulation secondary to IgE cross-linking by a donor antigen. So I'll give you a second to think about that. I will encourage you to make your diagnosis first and then the answer becomes obvious. So the answer should be C. Right. So basically preformed antigen against donor red blood cell antigens. Right. So basically this is something called an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction. So let me just tell you this right now. Transfusion reactions are super high yield to know for step one, super high yield to know for step two, super high yield to know for step three. Your friends at the MBME know that people just find this to be difficult to understand. So they just sort of give up on it. Okay. So let me sort of break it down for you and sort of tell you the different ways this can be tested and describe the pathophys. So the thing is, so this one I'm referring to here with this question is an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction. Basically, the pathophase is that you form like autoantibodies against like donor, like red blood cell antigens that you're getting from the person that's donating blood. Okay. So let's say, for example, you have like an A blood group. Since you have an A blood group, you have like A antigens on your red cells. So you form anti-B antibodies because you don't have B red blood cells. You have A red blood cells. So you form anti-B antibodies, right? So if you get like a B red blood cell transfusion, you get into trouble, right? And really the thing that happens is the antibodies that you already have, the preformed antibodies you have in your serum, they basically bind to the donor red blood cell antigen, they activate complement, and you basically have like an intravascular hemolysis, Okay, that's what really causes the hemoglobinuria. This is basically like, again, AB incompatibility that you hear about all the time, clerical error. This should never happen. This is like a never event that should really never happen in a hospital. If you do your job properly, although again, no one is above a mistake, right? Humans make mistakes. But I just want to go ahead and emphasize that this is actually a process that is not mediated by mast cells. It is mediated by preformed antibodies. Usually it's IgG. Okay, this is actually a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, right? So it'll be like Coombs test positive. The reason I'm spending my time emphasizing these details is that we can very easily use this to link up hematology with immunology. Okay, so this is a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Remember, type 2 hypersensitivity reactions basically involve like, I sort of think of it as like an antibody binding to an antigen on the surface of a cell. That's like the critical thing here. Antigen that's on the surface of a cell that's bound by an antibody that activates complement and destroys that cell. Okay, that's a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Contrast that with a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction where you have the antigen binding to an antibody. Okay, but usually that antigen-antibody complex, the antigen is not usually from a cell. It's usually like something else, like a basement membrane or something. And then those things go and deposit in some organ, and then that antibody activates complement, and then you destroy that organ, okay? So it's kind of important to understand that. Hopefully I'll have some time in the future to do an immunology podcast to sort of delineate those differences nicely, okay? But basically, acute hemolytic transfusion reaction is a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, right? So the Coombs test positive. Now, contrast this with like IgA deficiency, for example, right? So think about it, right? If a patient has IgA deficiency, classically they get like anaphylaxis with blood transfusions on exams, right? So the pathophysiology basically involves autoantibodies in the person receiving the blood transfusion against IgA antibodies that are in like the blood that is being donated, okay? So basically, the thing that happens is when you have the transfusion happening, the IgA from the donor, okay, basically cross-links IgE that is already on the surface of mast cells or basophils in the recipient of the blood transfusion. And that basically triggers the release of like histamines and like other leukotrienes that basically mediate the anaphylactic reaction, right? This actually happens like super quick, like literally while the patient is getting the transfusion. And this is actually a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. In fact, some people call this an allergic transfusion reaction. Although as you'll see as we go along, there are other types of allergic transfusion reaction. But IgA deficiency, like the anaphylactic reaction they get, is like a super severe allergic transfusion reaction. Okay, so again, basically, these people, they have IgA deficiency. Because they have IgA deficiency, IgA is a foreign protein to them. So they make antibodies against it, right? So let's say in the process of making those antibodies, they somehow magically get access to interleukin-4. And then that interleukin-4 helps you class switch to IgE, okay? And then that IgE basically parks on the surface of like a mast cell basophil. So when you now get a blood transfusion that contains IgA, that IgA will go bind to that IgE, you get cross-linking of that IgE, and then you have a massive release of like histamines and leukotrienes, and then get an anaphylactic reaction, okay? Again, it's super high yield to know this is a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction, okay? I know you may say, Divine, you've repeated this so many times. I'm repeating it because this thing tends to keep like no people on USMLEs. I don't want you to fail questions like this. An acute hemolytic transfusion reaction is a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, okay? It's Coombs positive. An IgA deficiency blood transfusion anaphylaxis is a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. The presentation is very similar, but the mechanisms behind them are very different, okay? So please do not mix this up on an exam. The next step up, I guess, will be like an acute non-hemolytic, right? An acute non-hemolytic. Remember the first one I talked about was acute hemolytic transfusion reaction. And then I talked about like IgA deficiency. Now I'm talking about an acute non-hemolytic transfusion reaction. Basically, it's the same thing as the reaction you get with IgA deficiency. But the big difference is that the antigen is not IgA, okay? But the mechanism is the same. Mechanism is the same, but the antigen is not IgA, Okay, you could basically think of IgA deficiency as like a, you know, like a severe subset of an acute non-hemolytic transfusion reaction. So obviously an acute non-hemolytic transfusion reaction is a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. And then under transfusion reaction, you may see on an exam is like a febrile non-hemolytic transfusion reaction. Basically, this one, it arises in the setting of, you know, like they tell you the person got a transfusion and then they got like a fever afterwards. They may have like some, you know, like mild myalgias and stuff like that. This is probably the most common transfusion reaction. So a febrile non-hemolytic transfusion reaction. Basically, the pathophase here is that sort of like cytokines from white blood cells in the stored donor blood. So cytokines like IL-1. Remember, IL-1 is a pyrogen. Okay, so it can cause fever. Okay, the way you can sort of prevent this is with something called like leukoreduction. You basically get rid of the white blood cells in the stored blood so that you don't have that buildup of cytokines, so you don't get into this problem. Okay, alternatively, what if you get a question and they say, oh, the patient has like jaundice and they have like pallor, right? And they have jaundice and let's say they give you labs and you see like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia and they have like pallor like days after a transfusion reaction. So let's say like 7 days or something like that. And then they tell you that, oh, they did a Coombs test and it was positive. The thing you want to think about here is a delayed hemolytic transfusion reaction, okay? Basically, the mechanism is the same as the acute hemolytic transfusion reaction I talked about earlier. But so it's like a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. But the thing that happened in this case is that you either did not have preformed antibodies, so maybe you formed the antibodies after the transfusion happened, or the preformed antibodies that were present were not in high enough concentration to cause like a significant hemolysis that was clinically detectable, like while the transfusion was going on. Okay, the antigens are usually minor, like anti-RH antigens. I think there's like anti-KEL, so K-E-L-L antigens that sort of mediate some of these processes. So again, let me just sort of summarize. An acute hemolytic transfusion reaction is a type 2 hypersensitivity. This one occurs, flank pain, blood in the urine, hypotension, right while the person is getting the transfusion. But if you have the same, if you basically have like similar presentation, similar but less severe presentation like days later, think about a delayed hemolytic transfusion reaction. They are both, again, type 2 hypersensitivities. IgA deficiency, having anaphylaxis as a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. The close cousin is the acute non-hemolytic transfusion reaction. Is the same mechanism as IgA deficiency mediated anaphylaxis, but the antigen is not IgA, okay, and it's usually less severe. Okay, so both of those are type 1 hypersensitivity reactions. I mean, some other weird things you may see, let's assume they tell you, oh, patient has like, you know, like shortness of breath after a blood transfusion, and then they show you like a chest x-ray that sort of looks like ARDS. You want to think about something known as TRALI, so like T-R-A-L-I, transfusion-related acute lung injury. Really, no one really knows the mechanism, but I guess one thing you may see is like, oh, they say like, oh, you have like donor autoantibodies against like recipient white blood cells. It's kind of like a weak explanation. No one really knows why this happens. And then let's assume a patient, right, gets like, you know, like a large volume blood transfusion, and then they tell you that, oh, they have like GVD, so like jugular venous distension. You're listening to their lungs, you hear like crackles. You want to think about something that is like TACO. So like transfusion associated circulatory overload. Basically, you essentially give this person like too much blood, so you've overloaded the circulatory system, so that extra fluid basically you're giving them sort of like drowns out their lungs, and then they begin to have like almost like heart failure style symptoms. And one other thing I want you to remember, right, so what if you get a question about a patient gets a blood transfusion and then they begin to have like tetany after getting that blood transfusion, and let's say like they have like, you know, positive Trousseau or Schwarzsteg sign. Remember, Schwarzsteg sign is where you tap the cheek, and then you have like facial spasms. It's like, I think it's like cranial nerve 7 that sort of have like some weird things going on there. Or you like do a blood pressure cough, and then they have like carpopedal spasms. That's like the Trousseau sign. And then let's say, oh, you get an EKG and you see like a prolonged QT interval. Hopefully you're thinking about hypocalcemia. Remember that if you take blood from someone, you obviously don't want your clot, right? Clotted blood is like kind of useless, right? So usually blood that is stored contains EDTA. But guess what? EDTA is a powerful calcium chelator. So if you give a large volume blood transfusion, that citrate or EDTA that's in the blood can basically bind up the calcium in the patient's serum and cause like a clinically significant hypocalcemia. Okay, so sort of think of that at the back of your mind on exams. And then remember, right, if a patient has like one of these hemolytic transfusion reactions, remember that potassium is primarily an intracellular ion. So as you are having that hemolysis of those red blood cells, that can basically spill potassium into the circulation. That can cause hyperkalemia. So they may show you that on an exam as having like peaked T waves on an EKG or like the white QRS and whatnot. Obviously, you want to initiate hyperkalemia protocol for those patients, right? So like calcium gluconate to stabilize the myocardium, especially when you see those white QRS complexes. You want to give like K-exalate, right, to make them poop out the potassium, although K-exalate causes like bowel necrosis. You want to give stuff like, what else am I thinking about? You want to give like insulin with glucose. You want to give furosemide, because remember, loops, right, they make you volume down, so they activate your renin angiotensin aldosterone system, so you basically poop out a potassium because aldosterone is running high. You can also give like sodium bicarb, because that sodium bicarb, right, will create an alkalosis, so that will drop protons out of your cells, and then potassium will go in the reverse direction. But yeah, this is sort of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. These are, again, if you notice this, in fact, literally when I upload this podcast, I'm going to call it the hematology podcast. But if you notice, I'm not, maybe this is more like 50% hematology, but I've talked about many other things, right? I've talked about some immunology. I've talked about some nephrology. I've talked about many other things, right? So again, just one of those weird things. This is, the thing is on step one. Step one is not based on your ability to just memorize details. Step one is really based on your ability to integrate information, right? So sort of see how things sort of link between our different concepts. So that's all I'm going to say about hematology in this first podcast. There'll be probably be like a few more hematology podcasts, because I want to cover all of hematology as relevant, and I guess oncology as relevant to step one. I already talked about the drugs, so there are podcasts for those. Just sort of go back and look for them on my website. But I'll see you in the next podcast. Hopefully, I have some time from intern year to make some more podcasts. So just as I round up, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. And I also want to mention that I offer one-on-one tutoring, so basically private tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CS, Step 2 CK, and Step 3 exams. I have tutored tons of students. Pretty much all of them. Actually, I've never had a student fail any of those exams that I've tutored. And most of them got like 30-40 point improvements between like step one and step two, for example, or between their first practice test and their final exam. And then I also tutor for the internal medicine in training exam and also the internal medicine board exams, right? So the ABIM board exams. And then I have like some admission committee experience, actually a lot of admission committee experience. So I prepare like ERAS applications for residency. I do mock interviews and also prepare like AMCAS applications for med school. Okay. And then one other weird thing I do for some reason is I also tutor organic chemistry. So if you ever have anyone that for some weird reason needs organic chemistry tutoring, I also offer one-on-one tutoring for that. So I'll see you in the next podcast, and we will very soon be reaching the 1-year anniversary of the Divine Intervention podcast. I'll probably try to make a podcast on that day, just as like an anniversary podcast. It'll be kind of nice if I could get to episode, episode 100 at our anniversary or something, but we'll see what happens. We're already at 79 episodes, and we have more than 200 hours, if I'm not mistaken, of content already. So I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful day, and I'll probably try to get like 3 hours of sleep before I get up and get back on the floor. So I'll see you next time. Have a great day, and God bless. Thank you.